Yeah, good morning. Call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, May 8th, 2024. Want everybody to silence their cell phones. The time is 9:30 a.m. on Wednesday. I'm joined by Co-Chair Hoffman. Co-Chair Stedman is busy doing other legislative work. We have Senator Bishop here, Senator Wilson, Senator Keel, and Senator Merrick will be by shortly. Let's see, we've got five bills we're going to try and get at this morning. HB 50, which is the main bill, HB 126, HB 19, HB 81, and HB 144. Due to scheduling, my best guess that we won't be able to get to HB 50 and the first two House bills this morning. We'll update everybody when they're ready to come back up. House Bill 50, Carbon Capture Utilization and Storage by the Governor. The intention is to finish the introductory presentation from the Department of Natural Resources, take additional invited testimony, and then public testimony. Mr. Crowder, please come on up with Ryan Fitzpatrick. Introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with the presentation.
Thank you very much, Chair Olson. For the record, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. And resuming our presentation here today on slide 14, I believe we had concluded our discussion of slide 13, and so we will move right into this slide. This slide summarizes what we've termed, or what we're calling the commercial terms of the bill. Specifically, those are included in the version before the committee, the minimum per acre charge for renting state acreage and the minimum injection fee per ton of carbon dioxide injected into state lands. Those charges are the minimums that are the basis for state revenue. Under the bill, there's discretion for the state to include additional commercial terms where appropriate so that we can achieve more revenue if projects, if the economics of projects allow that. There's also a special exception included by the Senate Resources Committee where at the stage from a conversion from a lease to a license, the commissioner can make a finding if the economics of the project, if to allow a project to move forward, compel a lower commercial term. We would note that that authority would likely be used in the context of potentially an in-state energy project where the economics are marginal and there's a benefit of in-state energy use associated with allowing that development. Just for a very brief history, this provision, as I said, was introduced in Senate Resources. There were original commercial terms included in the legislation as introduced. Those match what were added back in at Senate Resources after the House Resources Committee removed them in favor of additional flexibility. Unless there's questions, I'd move to the next slide.
I'd like to recognize that Senator Merrick was asked to join us about 10 minutes ago. Go ahead.
And slide 15, I won't go through all of these rows on this chart, but for the committee's awareness, the department has been conducting extensive outreach, coordination, and review with other states that have carbon leasing of pore space in their states to see the kinds of commercial terms that they're offering. You'll see from the material in this chart, states are adopting different kinds of provisions to capture value, which we have the flexibility to do under this bill, and the minimums that are now included in the bill fall within the range of what we're seeing for other projects. So happy to speak to these if there are questions, but this is really included as background information about the due diligence the department's been doing.
Any questions by members of the committee for Mr. Crowder? If not, go ahead, Mr. Crowder.
All right. Thank you, Chair. Slide 16, we have a very brief summary of the changes, material changes that have been made in some of the other committees as they've reviewed the substance of this legislation. I'd note that the department believes the bill, as before the committee, addresses the whole suite of regulatory and leasing provisions needed. So we think the language is highly functional and appropriate at this stage, and all of these different issues have been well addressed. I would start by noting the EPA Class 6 amendments, so that feedback from the Environmental Protection Agency as to how the state can achieve the primacy necessary to pursue these wells necessary for injection. Feedback came from the EPA and was incorporated by House Finance, and that's reflected in Section 34 of the bill. Similarly, the Senate Resources Committee wanted to make sure the bill included clear language about the dismantlement, removal, and restoration of the facilities. And so that's now included in Section 17, just like the dismantlement for other uses of state land. There's clear, in Section 55, there's clear direction for the Department of Environmental Conservation to ensure the regulation of carbon dioxide pipelines to promote safety and environmental protection. The additional topic addressed in the Senate Resources Committee was to ensure that the language is clear that the Department of Natural Resources, when it evaluates carbon storage, also looks at other subsurface resources, including natural gas storage. And so we believe both the best interest finding process in the bill and this clear language now in Section 17 address that concern from the Senate Resources Committee. And finally, I would note a topic we've discussed in this committee, the removal of the currently in place incorporated by reference state tax credits under 45Q are removed by Section 49 of the bill.
I'd like to go ahead and welcome Senator Stidman to the committee meeting this morning. He was busy doing other legislative work. Mr. Crowder, continue, please.
Yes, sir. I believe this brings us to our final slide, slide 17. And this just notes the core components of the bill that are focused on carbon capture, utilization, and storage. I'd highlight for the committee, there's a quick summary here, but Section 17 primarily deals with the department's leasing authorities so that we can lease pore space like we do for other state resources. And Section 34 primarily deals with the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission's regulatory framework. All of the other sections highlighted in this slide do associate with those authorities, but those are the key operative provisions of the bill. And then finally, we summarize on this slide some of the topics that were included in the bill by the Senate Resources Committee. That includes the release of Cook Inlet seismic data, which is within the Department of Natural Resources. It includes gas storage facilities regulation associated with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, provisions affecting the corporate income tax, and then also some terms of a program for reserves-based lending that would be led by ADA, the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority.
Any questions by members of the committee for Mr. Crowder or Mr. Fitzpatrick? If not, thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you, sir.
Next up we have is Nick Fulford with Gaffney Klein as consultant to the Legislative Budget and Audit. Mr. Fulford, please identify yourself for the record and go with the presentation.
Good morning, Chair Olson and Senators. For the record, my name is Nicholas Fulford, and I'm a Senior Director at Gaffney Klein. So I know there's a PowerPoint that's about to be shared, but just by way of introductory comments, I've been working now for the last 4 or 5 years on a variety of carbon capture and sequestration projects, not just in the US, but around the world. My particular interest is typically in the sort of commercial and contractual features of the projects, and really in the investment case that goes with them. So really it's with that lens that I'd like to talk to you today. So just to provide some context, the EPA monitor emissions very closely, and they produce a very comprehensive database of emissions. And so for Alaska, for the state, the emissions from stationary sources, which is what we're focused on.
Mr. Camp, we're going to take an at ease. Call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. Mr. Fulford, please continue.
Thank you. As I was just saying, I think it helps to put the context of carbon capture in Alaska into both a U.S. and a global perspective. So based on the EPA database, the total state emissions from Alaska are 14.3 MTPA. That's millions of metric tons per annum. And so just to give you a sense of what that means, Louisiana, for example, would be 150 million tons. Texas would be 450 million tons. And globally, the total CO2 emissions are something like 35,000 million metric tons. So as you can see, from the point of view of the global perspective, it's still a relatively small amount, but on a per capita basis, it's clearly much, much bigger. Now, the other thing that sets Alaska apart is that the vast majority of these emissions arise from Prudhoe Bay and the North Slope operations. So about 62% of Alaska's emissions come from operations on the slope. Again, if you look at Texas, Louisiana, most other states in the U.S., the predominant source of emissions is power generation. So this characteristic sets Alaska apart a little bit. And so the installation of a 2 million ton per annum capture facility on the North Slope, which is the example I'm going to focus on today, it would reduce the total state emissions by 14%, which, obviously is a very material reduction. And what I feel is particularly significant, particularly in the way that carbon markets are developing, is that it would reduce the carbon intensity of Prudhoe Bay oil by 140 kilograms of CO2 equivalent. The equivalent feature means that it includes methane as well. So 140 kilograms per barrel, which would be a very material change. So in terms of 45Q, which I know you're all very familiar with and you've heard about, the 45Q tax credits on a plant of that size would amount to $170 million per annum. And of course, that means that $170 million per annum of federal tax payable would have to be offset against it, which is one of the challenges with many of these schemes. So over the next three slides, what I want to do is to paint a picture of what one of these schemes would look like. I've broken it down into the carbon capture element, then the transportation from the carbon capture plant to the storage facility, and then an allowance for storage. As I go through these slides, there are some key features to think about. For any of these carbon capture projects to work, those three numbers that I'm about to present, they have to add up to less than $85 a ton, because that's the economic limit presented by the 45Q credits. For the examples that I've got, in order to bring that number down to what would be a commercial investment case, I've also had to include some what I would describe as fairly aggressive assumptions. So, for example, I've assumed that the investor would be investing on the basis of an 8% return on capital and 8% IRR post-tax. The investment profile has been fairly compressed. I've assumed very low energy costs and a number of other assumptions that I'll go through. So if there are no questions on this slide, I will continue.
Do we have any questions for Mr. Fulford on the slide? No, thank you very much. Go ahead with the next slide.
Thank you. So in terms of this hypothetical 2 million ton per annum facility on the North Slope, this is the kind of cash flow and financial outcome that you might expect to see. I would draw your attention to the y-axis on this graph, the financial inflows and outflows. And you'll notice that this is by far the most dominant feature of the three elements building up to the total. In this example, there's about $500 million of CapEx required. And the tariff, or the effective income that would have to be gained to justify that, would be around $60 a ton. And of that, about a third of it comes from sort of CapEx-related features, but the majority comes from operational expenses. And for a carbon capture project, much of that would be the energy consumption. And the other feature, I think, on this slide to note is that the capture element of the CCUS chain is the one which is most variable. So to give you an idea, if you were applying this investment to a gas processing facility, the CapEx might be perhaps two-thirds or a half of what it is here. If you're applying it to a gas-fired cogeneration facility, for example, it could be as much as double. So being able to install a capture plant within these economic parameters would be the key question in terms of feasibility.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Bishop.
Mr. Fulford, what did you baseline this hypothetical on as an existing plant that's in production somewhere else around the world is my first question.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Fulford.
Through the chair, I would respond that the financial features reflect what you might find in a capture plant in Louisiana or Texas or somewhere like that. Typically, I think investors would be looking for a more aggressive return on a project of this sort. But in order to illustrate what might be possible in Alaska, I've relaxed some of those more commercially sensitive assumptions. So I would say that this is reflective of projects that are being invested in today, but that the financial returns are probably less generous.
Follow up. For my
education, two questions I'll roll into one. Is this a direct air capture point source, or is this a air capture? And is this factored on the $130 ton 45Q credit?
Direct air capture would be almost an order of magnitude higher cost than this.
So this is a point source, if that's what you just said.
It would be an amalgamation of gas turbines, compressor facilities, and things of that sort that lend themselves to a relatively economic capture mechanism. So just to give you an example, one of the biggest refineries in Texas, the EPA data has about a 5 or 6 million ton emissions level. If you look at that refinery in detail, there's probably 3 or 4 major CO2 sources that lend themselves to capture and the rest doesn't. So as you look at those North Slope emissions, you can immediately assume that probably two-thirds of those North Slope emissions will be from, standalone, diesel engines and things of that sort, for which capture would not be feasible. So in answer, it would be an amalgamation of various types of plant that would get you to 2 million tons per annum.
Thank you.
Any other question for Mr. Fulford? Not, go ahead and continue, please.
So this next slide shows what the cash flows would look like for the transportation element. In general, the economic headroom in a CCS project might support a 40 or 50 mile pipeline. In this case, I've assumed, in order to create an economic business case, I've assumed that the distances involved would be much lower, which I think would be the case on the North Slope. So this involves a 15 mile pipeline. And again, you can see that the sort of proportion of the tariff of just over $7 in this case, the majority of that would arise from OPEX and compression, things of that sort. So this slide and the following one represent much more predictable financials. This would be akin to the construction of a reasonably substantial gas pipeline with different types of steel and various features which would make it more expensive. But fundamentally, it involves compression and involves transportation of the CO2.
Go ahead and continue.
So this third slide, and apologies, there is an error on this slide. I will provide a corrected slide for the record. The corrected number should represent a tariff of around $5 per ton of CO2. And again, this involves the drilling of injection wells. It would include also monitoring wells and other infrastructure, particularly geared around the measurement, monitoring and verification of the project. As you know, there's a provision for clawback in 45Q, so carefully measuring the CO2 that goes into the storage facility is key from a tax perspective, and ensuring that its integrity is maintained is another key feature. The rather unintuitive cash flows in here involve a process whereby typically CO2 would be injected into a particular strata. That strata would be essentially filled up, and the well would be plugged, and the injection would move up. So with the storage, periodically there is additional capex that has to be expended, and that's what's reflected on here. But the overall tariff with these for the storage would be around $5. And that would get you to about a $72 per ton tariff with these three examples added together. The reason it doesn't add up to $85 is that there are a variety of other costs. And in fact, I haven't included, for example, the state fees that might apply for the storage on this model. Equally, the utilization would typically not be 100%. And the contract between the capture entity and the storage entity, if that's the way it's done, would typically involve a set of liabilities and so forth, which would add cost. So what you see on these three slides is a kind of aggregated sum of the majority capture, some additional tariff for transport, and additional for storage. So really, these financials and the profiles, they reflect what a project of this sort on the North Slope might generate.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's kind of new to us, the carbon storage caper, and I have a little confusion on, you know, if we do the storage and we have a state fee, which is revenue coming in the door, but then we have potentially the tax offset from the credits against our corporate income tax. And I'm under the impression, under quite a few assumptions, we could actually have a negative cash flow from the state's perspective. So could you help us along with through your presentation, try to understand that a little bit? Because we've had conversations earlier over the last year that, you know, carbon storage may be a revenue generator for the state, but then we've had some of these numerics presented to the committee that actually show the reverse of that. So I need to know if we're going to go forward or backwards financially.
Mr. Fulford, enlighten us, please.
Through the chair, yes, it's a the question posed involves a whole series of both policy and sort of taxation effects. And in fact, later on in the presentation, I have some other projections which might help put this in place. But the response I would provide, I think, is that the Alaskan economy is fundamentally driven by oil and gas production and most likely will be for some time to come. The trends within the industry in terms of investability and the way in which the direct costs of carbon are working their way into the oil and gas supply chain are such that mitigation of CO2 with respect to oil and gas is becoming increasingly important and could have an increasing effect on the economy of the state. One of the features which I'll come on to, but I think in the context of the question it's worth mentioning now, is the increasing tendency for the carbon content involved in the production of oil to be factored into the price. As I think you're aware, you know, the Prudhoe Bay oil production is relatively carbon intensive. And in the longer term, you might expect to see, therefore, a discount in that price, or alternatively, a price enhancement for oil that's been decarbonized. So I think it's helpful to put the question into sort of two buckets, really. One is the direct impact of CCUS investments and the storage and the fees which may accrue to the state. And the other is the sort of broader strategic benefits which may arise from these indirect features. I would contend that these broader strategic revenue consequences in the coming years would probably eclipse the investments that are directly made into CCUS. But equally, the state isn't in the business of allowing investments that detract from state revenues. A shorter answer to the question is that now that the 45Q tax consequences are effectively isolated from state corporate income tax, the revenues involved, the returns to the companies involved, they should generate, in my opinion, they should generate additional tax revenue, provided the $85 limit can be exceeded and some degree of margin can be achieved in that. It should represent a profitable investment for the companies involved, which should consequently lead to revenues for the state.
Officer Stedman?
Just a quick follow-up. I know it's one of the reasons why we bring in hired dealers like you to help us, so we don't make a mistake, because if we make a mistake, it's extremely difficult for us to back up and fix it. A mistake meaning more money going out the door than coming in. So that's where a lot of the committee members are a little cautious that we don't make a mistake as we set these initial policies on this relatively new arena of carbon capture and storage.
Mr. Fulford, please continue.
Thank you, Chair. This slide actually summarizes much of what we were just discussing. So for the carbon capture, transportation and storage, clearly there's a property tax element to that. There's a corporate income tax element, provided the investment can be made profitably. And as we've heard from DNR, there would be a potential storage fee revenue as well, which would be on a per acre and per ton basis. The other potential use of captured CO2, which not currently done in Alaska, but which has some potential, you know, possibly in further years, is for enhanced oil recovery. That's a use for captured CO2 that's quite prevalent in some other states like Texas and Louisiana. And of course, the premise for that would be to generate additional oil barrels from the captured CO2. And so if that were feasible, then that would lead to increased production tax and royalty because of that. As I mentioned, there are some longer-term features as well, one of which is the way in which oil from the North Slope would be priced in international markets, and I'll come on to that in a separate slide. And the other feature, which is very important for oil and gas investments, particularly since the state continues to have substantial potential in that area, is the impact on sort of IRR hurdle rates and the cost of debt. And what we're seeing is that states and economies where decarbonization has been aggressively followed, it does have a consequence in terms of the ability to raise capital in global markets, and it does reduce the cost of debt. So these are some of the indirect features which I was referring to in answer to Senator Stedman.
Senator Stedman has a question.
Just kind of a follow-up on my previous one, just again, because this is all kind of new to us. I need a little bit of help, too, on differentiating between just storage, like if we have Cook Inlet and we have another foreign country or whatever, you know, ship stuff in and we just store it for a fee, versus any enhanced oil recovery or benefit dealing with the North Slope, which is I understand that there's market forces driving purchases of hydrocarbons that are produced with a lower carbon footprint. I think that's probably going to be with us forever from the way it looks. So I understand that, but when we look at the Cook Inlet as a storage basin, I think we need to be very careful that we definitely, in that case, we have positive cash flow, that we're not getting offset with some other tax mechanism or something, so our base storage fee basically gets erased and we're giving up storage space in Cook Inlet for Jesus instead of the treasury.
Mr. Fulford.
Through the chair, yes. I started off the presentation talking about some of the differences between Alaska and some of the other states that are pursuing CCUS, and the concept that you described there, Senator Stedman, of large-scale imports from other countries is one thing. It's an investment opportunity for Alaska that doesn't exist anywhere else in the U.S. And in the longer term has the potential to be quite a significant investment. Just for context, Australia is pursuing exactly this with Japan and Korea. There are projects which are approaching FID, which are exactly that concept. Brunei, other countries that have significant depleted hydrocarbon resources, they're offering this service as well. So Alaska would be, as it were, competing with other potential takers for imported CO2. And of all the CCUS concepts, it's probably the least well-defined. And, not wishing to get into too much detail, the contractual features, particularly around long-term liabilities and so forth, would be key in terms of ensuring that the state carries no liability. And in that sense, a dialogue between the Alaska government and the exporting government is more likely to be required to ensure that the scenario that you described would not occur. So there's a host of features around this kind of long-term financial and other liabilities which would have to apply to a scheme such as that. But I appreciate that a considerable degree of caution would be needed as if the state were to move towards that kind of concept.
Well, Senator Stedman.
Yes, just briefly a data request as we go forward, and maybe you can help us on what these other countries charge for this type of environment for Cook Inlet. I have absolutely no idea. None. And that's because so we're starting at ground zero. I see what's in the legislation, things like that, and I recognize that Gaffney Klein worked with the administration on it, so there's got to be a lot of background data done, and I think it'd be nice for the Finance Committee at some time to come up to speed of what kind of value in potential in Cook Inlet we're sitting on, especially with the reference that we're the only one in the North Pacific that I'm aware of, and clearly, you know, so we're in a, looks like we're in a unique position to market our wares at a handsome price.
Through the chair, yes, I think I would certainly agree that the CCUS potential of the Cook Inlet potentially has a very high value in global terms. In response to your comment about data, the way I would approach that, I think, would be to perhaps do some modeling for the legislature, which sets out the kind of cost base for each part of the chain in this very different supply environment. I can tell you that order of magnitude, transoceanic shipping of CO2 from Asia to Alaska would be of the order of $50 a ton. So you can see that that's immediately a tenfold increase on the small matter of moving the CO2 a few miles. The most imponderable part of that business case is if you look at the capture side of it, without going into too much detail, the reason that countries like Japan are interested in CO2 capture and export is because they have a huge array of coal and gas-fired power generation, which are assets that have a life of many decades still. And the implications of having to decommission those plants and replace them with low or zero carbon generation is such that it provides a very strong economic driver to find ways to export the CO2. So that's the big imponderable. And that's really what drives these schemes.
Just as another brief follow-up, you know, I recognize other states are, and that we have these potentials, similar potentials in the Gulf Coast. But with Cook Inlet, it's a tidewater, and there's no other place on the coast that I'm aware of anywhere close to that. So it makes it difficult for me to go and look at the other states and see what they're charging, because that's a whole different environment, I think, that Cook Inlet's going to compete in, which is a global marketplace mm-hmm. for the Pacific. And it may have a much handsomer reward than looking at what other states are doing, Louisiana or Texas or any part of North Dakota or anywhere else.
Yeah, through the chair, I think my comments on that would be that while there is a flurry of investment going on today, particularly Louisiana, Texas as well, other states too, but I would say Louisiana is probably the focus for much of the CCUS investment right now. And I would venture to suggest that very few people in Louisiana are even thinking about transoceanic shipment of CO2. It's a much more immediate requirement for, you know, hundreds of millions of tons of CO2 that originate from power generation and from the petrochemical industries. So for Alaska, this longer-term import model is almost unique. And so in terms of the design parameters and commercial side and costings, probably that there's limited amount that you could learn from what's going on in the Gulf Coast. It is a very new concept. It's just started in Europe. There's CO2 being shipped on vessels from Denmark up to Norway, but it's quite a nascent industry.
Bob Center Simon. Go ahead, Mr. Fulford.
Thank you. So I did want to briefly talk about EOR. because the economics are different. And so on the right-hand side of this slide, I've prepared a sort of a high-level comparison of EOR versus geological storage. So as you're all aware, I think the tax credit for geological storage is $85 a ton. For enhanced oil recovery at 60. So for an investor in CCUS to follow an EOR course as opposed to geological sequestration, they'd be looking at a $25 differential in their revenue, but they would also have avoided costs of about $12 a ton. So the gap between a storage case and an EOR case would amount to about $13 a ton. And I can tell you from other projects and due diligence work that we've done, particularly in the lower 48, the typical prices that you might see for a CO2 sale can be as low as $3. And in one case I'm aware of, which was a relatively small quantity, could be as high as $20 a ton. So as you look through that, the project outlook for an EOR investment based purely on the 45Q revenues, it could be in the region of a $10 per ton loss or a $7 per ton gain. Interestingly, this has led to a dialogue in some other states as to whether 45Q disproportionately encourages investors to follow a sequestration path as opposed to an EOR one. And Wyoming in particular have decided that it's appropriate to introduce an additional supplement in order to encourage EOR to take place where the benefit for the state is considered to be greater than geological sequestration. And obviously, as you're aware, many other states have other tax benefits for EOR too. But I just wanted to paint that picture just to give you a sense of why a company might choose to do EOR versus sequestration.
Please continue.
So with that, I wanted to just comment briefly on the commercial structure and accounting treatment for carbon capture projects. First of all, I pointed out on the initial slide that we're looking at federal tax credits of $170 million a year for a project of this scale. And the challenge often for CCUS projects is actually monetizing that tax credit in a way that can represent full value. I would say that most of the CCS projects that I've been involved with have involved very significant input from tax attorneys and other specialists in order to create a structure and a mechanism to fully monetize the credits. And the other feature of CCS is that under the IRS dispensation for low carbon investments, it would qualify for so-called modified accelerated cost recovery system, or MACRS, with a accelerated depreciation over 7 years. So again, from a structuring point of view, that's an important feature. So I think other than the complexity of structuring these projects to fully capture the federal tax credits, I think that's the key takeaway from this slide. And with that, I'll move on. Earlier on, I'd referred to the increasing trend to incorporate carbon intensity into the price of a particular blend of oil. And just one example of that is the so-called carbon border adjustment mechanism. It's one mechanism which is designed to ensure that treatment of carbon in one jurisdiction doesn't create an imbalance in terms of imported products into another. The basis for the mechanism is that the carbon intensity of products have to be either paid for through an adjustment or dealt with by the exporter. So just an example of how this might affect Prudhoe Bay oil. I mentioned that 140 kilos per barrel of CO2 emissions could be saved through a 2 million ton scheme. And if you work through the economics at the 85 euros per ton figure, which applies in Europe, then that amounts to in the order of $90 million a year of additional production and royalty for the state of Alaska. So as I mentioned in my earlier remark, this is an emerging feature of the energy sector, but it's one which could be quite significant for Alaska in the future.
Chairman. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Nick. I've been waiting for this slide because I had written a note earlier. So I'm going to put it out in my plain English. There's incentives for future oil production by looking at this prospectively going forward. As I listen to you speak and then land on this slide as a resource-based oil economy on the North Slope, there could be incentives for a premium on oil sales, or there could be a decrement on oil sales if you're not in this game, depending upon the client. Is that a true or false statement?
Mr. Fulford.
Thanks. And through the chair, I think, Senator Bishop, what you said there is quite accurate.
Thank you.
So, you know, it depends how you look at it. By investing in carbon capture, you're likely to enhance the value of Alaskan oil. By not investing, it could involve in a discount. Thank you. So this is my last slide. And again, I referred to this earlier on, but as I'm sure you'd be aware, oil majors and other energy companies are finding it increasingly difficult to raise finance for a host of reasons that are mostly to do with climate policy and CO2. And you know, the extent to which these mitigations that we've talked about in today's presentations could occur, it would mitigate that effect. It would make Alaska a more investable destination for oil and gas capital. So just to give you an idea, for every $1 billion invested, it would result in about a $6 million per annum saving for each 10 mils on the cost of debt. So in aggregate, it could have a big effect, and it's certainly a feature worth considering. So that concludes my prepared remarks.
Okay. Do you have any questions from members of the committee for Mr. Fulford? Senator Stedman.
Just a brief comment. I'd just like to thank you for putting this together and coming to the committee on such short notice. A lot of people don't recognize that we didn't have a consultant to deal with this for a while, and it's just nice to have Gaffney Klein back working with the legislature.
Thank you, Senator Stedman, and I always appreciate the opportunities to provide testimony to be helpful for the Alaska legislature. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Any further questions by members of the committee for Mr. Fulford? No, thank you very much for coming out, coming all this way. Calling at ease now. Call the Senate Finance Committee meeting back to order. We're in the process of passing around the committee substitute that was just ordered last night, came out this morning. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Senate Finance Committee substitute for House Bill 50 Finance Work Order 33-GH1567/N be adopted as our working document.
Okay, I'll object for the discussion. Mr. Alper, please explain the changes.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ken Alper, staff to Senator Olson on the Finance Committee. The end version of the committee substitute you have in front of you, to be clear, reflects no policy decisions being made on the primary guts of the bill related to carbon capture, sequestration, and storage. What you have before you, Mr. Chairman, removes the elements from other legislation that was added in previous committees on related but not essential to the fundamental carbon topics. So the four changes, the four things are all removals from the bill. The first one are the sections related to making available certain seismic survey and geophysical data. That was in sections 35 and 36 of the previous version of the bill and originated in House Bill 257. The second thing that was removed were the sections related to regulating gas storage facilities, natural gas storage facilities. Those were in sections 41 through 47 and 56 of the prior version and originated in Senate Bill 220. The third change removed those sections related to taxation on income attributable to qualified entities. Those were sections 48, 58 to 59 and 62 through 64 of the prior version and originated in Senate Bill 114. And finally, the sections related to reserves-based lending at the Alaska Industrial Development Export Authority. Those were in sections 51 through 54 of the prior version and originated in House Bill 388. And I'll repeat, Mr. Chairman, the other sections of the bill that remains in the end version are entirely unchanged from what came to committee awaiting future policy decisions by this committee.
Do we have any questions by members of the committee for Mr. Alper? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just so I'm clear, change number three, that removes the language that dealt with the S-Corp issue. Is that correct?
Mr. Alper.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, yes, that is correct.
So, Mr. Chairman, that's that's a pretty sizable policy shift from what the Resources Committee sent us. To do that maintains the massive competitive advantage that our tax code today gives one of the three producers on the North Slope, different tax rate than either of the other big producers on the North Slope. Nothing's changed about the fields, nothing's changed about the rocks, nothing's changed about the oil. It just maintains a huge tax advantage to one of the three over the other two. So this CS, I know, is a work draft, and we've got more work to do. So I'm not going to lodge an objection right now, but that's a colossal problem that we've got to fix.
Any other comments by members of the committee about the changes, the four changes that were done, or specifically change number three? If not, I'll go ahead and remove my objection. Version N is now before us. Does that mean you have a question or comment?
I'm going to wait to see if there's any other objections, but apparently there's no other objection. But just want to reiterate, this piece of legislation has been peeled back and concentrated on carbon storage, mainly due to the time on the clock, trying to get done to the end. And I think, Mr. Chairman, the committee is going to take up these other items that have been pulled out for review for inclusion possibly later in another CS. But it'll focus our discussion on areas of the bill that are more pertinent to the clock and getting out of here. And then as we work through it, it should hopefully, between this and another piece of legislation, save us about a day of time, is what we expect and hope for.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would agree with Senator Keel. But given the timeline that we have, this probably should be discussed, but I don't know if this would be the proper bill to do that, and it may result in delays or not adequately addressing the implications of the carbon storage bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
There are a number of us that feel fairly passionately about the change that was number three went ahead and did. In the meantime, any other discussion by members of the committee? If not, we're going to go to invited testimony. First up is Christy Ressler, the president of ASRC Energy Services, who's online. Ms. Ressler, are you on, ma'am?
I am. Good morning. Can everyone hear me?
Coming in loud and clear. Just identify yourself for the record and go ahead. Go ahead.
Sorry, good morning, Co-Chair Olson and honorable members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Christine Ressler, and I am the president and CEO of ASSC Energy Services, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, or ASRC, is a native corporation. We were established pursuant, as you all know, I'm sure, relative to the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, with a dual mission of supporting the economic, social, and cultural well-being of its nearly 14,000 Inupiat shareholders. AES specifically has more than 40 years of experience serving Alaska and working in the Arctic. We are the state's largest oil field service provider, and we have approximately 2,500 Alaska full-time and seasonal employees. And we're seeing firsthand the growing interest in Alaska as a place to pursue carbon management. And the passage of the SB 48 last year, allowing the state to start the primacy process for Class VI wells, has been really good. And it started to attract additional interest globally. You know, going back to the implementation of the passing of the infrastructure law by the federal government, AES has worked really hard to create knowledge and insight and experience around carbon capture, because we feel it's really important to the state of Alaska. But without action now and passing both the DNR and AOGC authorities included in House Bill 50, we're afraid that Alaska is going to lose that momentum, and we'll see the interest and expertise currently focused on Alaska go to states that are making the steps to put in place their regulatory frameworks. And it's really competitive. Alaska is differentiated in terms of its interest for a lot of reasons, but we need the policy and regulation in place to sustain that interest. And if we don't do that, we're going to lose that interest. We need to be competitive, as I said, with the other locations, or again, that investment is going to go elsewhere. And you know, we've worked really hard along with a number of folks in the state to make this a really good, interesting, viable business for us in the future. So I'm really hopeful that we'll be able to do what we need to make that happen. It's our goal at AES to be a center of innovation for Alaska and to lead in the development and deployment of technologies that will ensure Alaska remains at the forefront of responsible resource development for the benefit of everybody here in Alaska. And that's one of the reasons why we started working on CCUS and understanding the opportunities here all the way back in, you know, in 2020. We helped companies manage every part. We help companies manage every part of the upstream and midstream development of oil and gas here in Alaska. We have systems for managing associated water, natural gas, and other hydrocarbons, which are integral to producing each and every barrel of oil. Its fields have evolved in the North Slope. We've treated seawater to enhance oil recovery. We've developed a municipal injection from other hydrocarbons, and as part of the regulatory environment, reinjection immense amounts of natural gas, because, as you know, we don't do much flaring here in Alaska, which is differentiating. It's a great thing. However, it's important to remember that we're a long way off from carbon management being a viable business. It's really in the early stages, and such a major part of the investment being deployed here in Alaska is doing some of the testing and analysis that still needs to be done, but that is going to be expensive, and it's not going to be done if we don't have the regulations in place so that people investing know that they have a potential future. We're currently partnered with Santos and Repsol, pursuing federal support through the infrastructure law to explore the possibility of carbon capture from point sources like gas turbines on the North Slope, as well as direct air capture. While we're in the early stages of exploring technologies and designs, having the regulatory framework, as I said, in House Bill 50 is going to be critical to our efforts for two reasons. Injecting carbon in storage requires a Class VI well. And the state is currently pursuing primacy thanks to, as we talked, I mentioned seconds ago, the legislation that was passed last year, which is great. But we need House Bill 50 as well to include the changes in the state law based on guidance from the EPA so that we have the full package to continue to, you know, pursue the investor interest that we have. Without regulatory and commercial framework for state poor states, we can't even do the basic technical, economic, and engineering work required to advance the technology because we don't know what the rules are that we're designing for. We're deeply concerned to see a straightforward establishment of a basic regulatory framework to establish companies like AES and others that I've mentioned to begin exploring what is required for carbon management, because the vehicle tax and other controversial policies will potentially have unintended consequences. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I want to be clear, I'm not a tax expert, and I know there's been a lot of discussion around that today. We're specifically well-versed in our state lease expenditure systems because, again, we're not a producer. But I do have some concerns, and I concur with a lot of things that have been expressed. Is one of the people that has worked really hard over the last 4 years to actually explore whether carbon is viable and a bit and enable, you know, to something that we can do here in Alaska. I feel like we're on the forefront and we want to continue with responsible resource development. And I think we need this to have that. I want to assure you that we have years of work to do before there are serious or substantial investments in the project. Then everyone needs to come into that with a realistic expectation. But I also want to assure you that failing to enact basic regulatory frameworks like we're proposing here envisioned this year will set Alaska back significantly and delay the critical work that needs to be done to protect our state's oil and gas industry. So I really want to thank you for letting me share my thoughts, and it's an honor to have the opportunity to speak with all of you today.
Do we have any questions for Ms. Ressler by members of the committee? If not, thank you very much for coming out this morning. Our next invited testimony is the Executive Director of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, Kara Moriarty. Please come on up and introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation. Welcome back to Senate Finance.
My favorite place in May. Chairman Olson, members of the Senate Finance Committee, for the record, I am Kara Moriarty. I'm the president and CEO of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, commonly referred to as AOGA. As you know, we're the professional trade association that represents the majority of producers, explorers, refiners, and transporters of oil and gas in Alaska. And our mission is to advocate for the long-term viability of the industry. I do appreciate the opportunity to provide invited testimony today to state officially on the record that we do support this original policy directive of House Bill 50, which now version N focuses on, to encourage investment in Alaska and to reduce carbon dioxide emissions through carbon capture, utilization, and storage. It is no secret the federal government has already developed a very robust CCOS regulatory framework that protects the environment and public health. And now, for Alaska to compete with other states, as Ms. Ressler just stated, to attract current industry investment in these types of activities and projects, the state needs this regulatory framework contained in House Bill 50. As it relates, though, to CCUS, there is one section of the bill that AOGA does not support, and that is now Section 40 in the current CS version N. As we understand, for a carbon capture and storage project that only captures and stores carbon without exploring for, developing, or producing oil and gas deposits, those costs, if it's solely a capture and storage project, those costs would not, under the current production tax statutes and regulations, qualify as an allowable lease expenditure. Costs associated with enhanced oil recovery, or EOR, including EOR using carbon, are currently and should remain an allowable lease expenditure. So as the committee evaluates creating a CCUS program in this bill, as you have done, we recommend that the state's CCUS program be designed in a manner that does not impact currently allowable lease expenditures. If the committee believes clarifying language regarding lease expenditures or allowable lease expenditure remains a priority and a necessary path forward for House Bill 50, we welcome the opportunity to work with you on alternative language than what is currently contained in Section 40. So with that, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that concludes my invited testimony, and I'm happy to take any questions that you might have.
Do we have any questions by members of the committee for Ms. Mayorty or the Executive Director of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association? I guess one of the questions I have is you look at Section 40 and you look, and I know that's a concern of many of the other producers up on the North Slope. If it's not taken out and remains in there, what would that, would there be much support for the bill after if that was the case, if it remains in there?
Mr. Chairman, that is something we're evaluating as we speak, as we go through the process. So I don't know that I know the answer to that question. It's just very concerning because the way we read the current language, it would impact current lease expenditures that are currently allowable lease expenditures, whether you have CCUS projects or not. And so that's the concern. And so, I'm not quite sure how we would come out on that if this current language remains, because it was not part of the original piece of legislation.
Right. And, we just got the CS, and I'm sure nobody has, or anybody has had the chance to go ahead and look at it except on a superficial level. With that, there's no further question by members of the committee for Ms. Mayorty. I want to thank you for coming out this morning. Thank you for staying here for the last several days.
No, my pleasure, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the invitation.
Okay, that pretty much concludes this morning's agenda. We will be coming back at 1:30 this afternoon, at which time we'll go ahead and look at the ADA hearings. There's nothing else to come before the committee. We're adjourned at 10:35.